scrolling. And get it off to Florida. Remember, they deserve special treatment. It's a big week for me. I hope this week to sign the contract on my new book. So I may still be ahead of Richie. How many books has your father published? I think I'm one ahead of him now. One or two ahead of him. So he's a little younger. We'll give him a chance to catch up. You don't know who a father is. Your father's a genius. Was he a normal father? How did you manage with him as a father? Not really. No, it's impossible. He couldn't. Your mother was normal, evidently. She kept you grounded. Who's that young man sitting next to you? You're from... do you guys drive me crazy? You come this day, that day. I don't know. I want to learn things, but I don't know what to say. We'll learn. Michael, good to see you. Okay.
Hello.
Now, today is November 15th, 2010. I want to say hello to all those sitting in front of me and all those listening. I just want to begin by making one comment, very fascinating. A student listening, Dr. Alan Blau, he was my student in the 70s, he and his brother, and he listens faithfully, he tells me, here for many years already. So he has another slightly different version. Remember, I quoted to you that at that graduation with Gershon Scholem, so Professor Liebman said that, or again, I wasn't there, but it swept the whole city, was what you call anecdotal, that he said the Kabbalah is Narishkeit, but the study of Narishkeit is scholarship. So Alan called me and I told him to put it into writing. He says his father, very brilliant individual, should have a full shlame, he's 100 years already suffering. His father, who was a Talmud of the Rav, or the Talmud of the Yeshiva, was at the graduation because he had studied under Professor Salo Barone at Columbia University, and he was also being honored by the seminary. And his father remembers Lieberman introducing Professor Gershon Scholem and saying, quote, Kabbalah is nonsense, but it takes a genius to understand it. So, so that's another take on what happened at that graduation. Sophie Sheldavad also says the same thing. What's interesting, again, I stress it to you because it's very important to understand that Gedolei Yisrael were different. The Rav would have never spoken like that. The Rav had a feeling for Kabbalah, for Dashanut, for Agadah, but Professor Liebman was Kulo Halacha. He had no feeling for anything beyond Halacha. And he kind of felt that Kabbalah was nonsense. I need not tell you, when it comes to Kabbalah, there's a whole machloket among chokrim, when it originated, what its origins are, and it's et cetera, et cetera. Now, picking up where we left off last week, I have to tell you that it dawned upon me, I remembered something very important, and it's like, you know, when you talk about something, ultimately it becomes maskin ishkachot, as they say. So, again, with what's going on out in the field and all the pressure on the rabbinate, and you can't start to understand what it meant. The seminary is isolated, Broadway and 122nd Street. The rabbis are out in the field, and this is a whole new generation. And you have to remember, my father's generation, my father was born in Harlem, but my father was only one generation removed from Europe. So my father still understood Yiddish, he had respect for Rabbanim. I think in my father's case there was a bit of a mystical respect which might have been a part of his generation. But now you're in a generation, two generations removed, three generations removed. And the rabbinical assembly, the rabbis have to satisfy them. The pressure on the rabbis is indescribable. So they come up with this committee on Jewish law. They come up with this concept. If three rabbis have an opinion, that opinion is valid for those who want to follow it. So we saw last week some of the questions that came up. Yontif Sheni, many different opinions, abolish it, don't abolish it, only abolish it if you can't get a minion. Rule of the thumb, in the big cities, Yontif Sheni remains a reality for conservative Jews. Out in isolated areas, yesh v'yesh. You see, if there are Orthodox shuls nearby and there's crowds going on Yom Tov Sheni to the Orthodox shuls, it leaves an impression on the conservative temple as well. But if you're totally isolated, the conservative temple will not feel any pressure to keep Yom Tov Sheni. When it comes to Stam Yenim, which we spoke about at the end of the class, I remembered what happened. And what happened was very interesting. And the Rav became a folk hero throughout New York. Why? Because when it comes to wine, nothing in the world is easier from a logical point of view, a rational point of view. What can be treif about wine? Shmuel, wine or grapes? Right or wrong? How can you make grapes treif? Now, no one is telling you to go into the church and take Yayin Nesach that they use in the Mass. We're talking about wine that's sold in the A&P and Safeway. I don't know today. And do they sell wine in ShopRite? Are you allowed to sell wine today? I don't know. I don't know what the
depends on the state.
Because I remember when I was growing up, you could get wine in the supermarkets. All right. What can be treif about wine? So the conservative movement, it would have been a unanimous decision by the Committee on Jewish Law. What happened was Rabbi Radin came to the Rav. And that's what I told you last week. And I see the picture in front of me. I see Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein as a youngster. And I see the Rav sitting behind his desk. Rabbi Radin is here. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein is here. And Rabbi Radin is here. And the Rav is dictating Torah and all the sources that he should show Rabbi Radin upstairs in the Gottesman Library, which was one flight above, on Stam Yenim. I remember the Rama, and he's telling him where to look in the Tshuva HaRama. It was amazing how much knowledge the Rav had. I mean, it's beyond words, because no matter what you ask the Rav, he could throw sources at you and give you an answer. Sam Dershowitz, Dr. Dershowitz, always tells the story. So the Sheminchan Marav on Shabbos afternoon in Boston, in Maimonides, the Rav would sit around and anyone could throw questions at him. It was a question and answer period. And Sam was there for many, 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 many years. He went on Aliyah from Boston. And Sam said, no matter what the question was, no matter what field, no matter what shayla, no matter, it could have been a general question, the Rav shot back at you not only an answer, but sources. So Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, we called him the Babe. In those years, Aaron was known as the Babe. He always had a big, round face. If you look at a baby, you notice a baby has a round face. Then as he starts to grow, the face sort of contorts a little. So we used to call Rav Aaron the Babe. That was his nickname in the yeshiva. So the Babe went upstairs with Rabbi Radin, and they sat in the library, and he showed them all the sources. Rabbi Radin comes to the Committee on Jewish Law, and Rabbi Radin presents the sources in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and believe it or not, two other rabbis agreed with him. And it now, that stopped the heter for using Gallo Brothers wine from becoming unanimous, and it was all due to the Rav. And that's now, after class, I kept on thinking about it because I knew there was something unique that happened. And it was the Rav, through Rabbi Radin, attracted a few more rabbis, and it became one of the valid positions of the Committee on Jewish Law that you're not allowed to drink non-kosher wine. Obviously, in the conservative movement in general, it's what I said last week, that for sacramental purposes, they use kosher wine. Beyond sacramental purposes, no one in the world would think of not using non-kosher wine.
This has
to be in the 50s, because I can tell you, you want in a year, it's probably 57, 58.
Well, that's certainly before the
I can tell you absolutely, because I'm in Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein sitting before the Rav and Rabbi Radin. This has to be in the mid-50s. Okay.
Three for
a valid opinion. A chumra, a kula, call it whatever you wish. But it has to be a valid opinion.
The tshuva, I think, that's now operative in the conservative movement is online and available by Rabbi Dork.
Right, right.
Basically, he presents both sides of the issue.
Right.
There are issues of kashrut in terms of what are called fire hits.
Well, I know that there are issues in relation to additives that they add. I know with Manischewitz wine, I was once in Chicago right before Pesach. I'm trying to think where it was for Pesach. I don't recall. I may have been in Florida. If I was in America for Pesach. Anyway, so in Chicago, right before Pesach, they have like a book sale, a Jewish organization, like in a tent, tremendous tent, endless books for sale, $1 a piece, $2 a piece, you know, all discarded books. Like everything else, you buy books and what was important 10, 20 years ago, you want to get rid of 20 years later. So at that book fair, a woman comes over to me, furious. She tells me a story that a year ago she bought Manischewitz wine for Pesach, and it turned out that it was not kosher, and for Pesach. So I took the woman's phone number, and I never got an answer. You should know, I don't like people who don't acknowledge. I go through the trouble of making a call, of finding out, of writing out an answer, and then don't even acknowledge, dear Rabbi Rakefet, we're happy to tell you we received your answer, thank you for your effort. So I say that. So I checked at the OU. To me, I mean, in the state of Israel, I don't know of any wine that's not kosher to Pesach. And when you buy wine, the truth is, before Pesach, no one even looks to check that it's kosher to Pesach, because before Pesach here, it's a festival, everything is kosher to Pesach. The stores all become kosher. It's a sight to see here, it's a Kiddush Hashem. And the prices go down. It's the only country in the world where prices go down before Pesach. Just the opposite of all over, because the cutthroat competition is so great, and as far as kashering, they don't view it as an extra expense. In the United States, they view kashering as an extra expense for Pesach. Why should a non-kosher product, Frito-Lays makes a run, let's say, I don't know if this is true or not, but for the sake of argument, Frito-Lays makes a run of kosher the Pesach potato chips, they're going to charge the Jew extra for all that they had to put in to kosher their equipment. In the state of Israel, everyone is Jewish. Most people in the food industry who work in the food industry, you'll notice, are from Jews. There are many reasons why. And you don't need a college degree to work in the food industry. And koshering is normal. You have to kosher your house, you have to kosher the factory, you have to kosher the milk, you have to kosher the soda. What's the big deal? The big Coca-Cola plant is where? You tell me. It's in Bnei Brak, of course. It's a landmark. Everyone says, I'll meet you at the Coca-Cola plant. It's a landmark in Bnei Brak. So all the wine here is kosher to Pesach. I never yet heard of wine that shouldn't be kosher to Pesach. So I asked the OU. I know many of the people in Kashrut, so they told me right away that Manischewitz wine has certain wines where they add additives to. Some of those additives, you get involved with alcohol, you get involved with a problem if it's a byproduct of grain, you get involved with byproducts of corn syrup, etc., etc. So the wine that doesn't have a hechsher, you got to take a look when you buy Manischewitz wine, that it should be UP. So that woman, I wrote to her that you take it with Manischewitz in America. You can't take it for granted because they make all these different types of wines. So what you're saying, Michael, is correct. But I want to know, Rabbi Dorf, he permits drinking non-kosher wine or he doesn't?
I think ultimately he says that there can be, you can argue that there are issues in terms of whether those clarities, clarifiers.
I don't know, but it would seem to me pure grape. All right, let it be.
But in Europe, there are more serious issues.
Yeah, in Europe,
some chemical reaction.
All right.
I don't know what it does or what it is.
I will only tell you that on this level, I am not a great expert. When you tell me ox blood already, I get frightened. Anyway, beside that, let the wine stand there. These issues are available online.
Even the law committee of the seminary.
Uh-huh.
These shubas are all available.
Well, including out of the 50s?
They go back a ways.
Yeah, be interesting. Okay, because I have a photograph in front of me of it. Go ahead, yeah.
It's not a matter of fascism, necessarily. It's not the
No, I understand, but they're claiming it's not just Stam Yainim, they're willing. No, Stam Yainim. No, no, I understand it. Stam Yainim, they're willing to waive, but Kashrut is a problem. This is what we're talking about.
I don't understand the whole concept, being honest, about Stam Yainim. No one is drinking wine today that was going to be used for a sacramental purpose.
No, it's for social reasons. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So you're trying to say we shouldn't drink whiskey with goyim, and you're absolutely right. I said that last week, but what can we do? Masha gazru gazru, masha lo gazru lo gazru. This is what Yiddishkeit is based upon, as the Rishonim say, halavai, we should observe that which we have to observe. Okay, now another question that came up, which also it got involved with 3-4 different opinions, is a question which today is no longer a problem for them. What's interesting is one of the opinions, I'll show you in a moment, counting women for minyan. And here, of course, you see the pressures of the outside world, the feminist movement. You cannot comprehend how strong feminism becomes in the 60s into the 70s, how strong it becomes in the conservative movement, and you all know it's a pattern. What the reform do in the 60s, the conservatives have to contend with in the 80s, and the Orthodox contend with another 20 years later, and in the Orthodox world today, I don't have to tell you, feminism and its implications, halacha lema'aseh, remains probably the most difficult issue we face, although, sadly enough, homosexuality rivals it today. And also there's a progression there. What the reform worried about in the 70s, the conservative in the 90s, and the orthodox in the 10s. Now, so when counting women to a minyan, I don't have to tell you, Me'ika Hadin, there were conservative rabbis who said right away, women do not count to a minyan, women are not obligated to pray like a man, the whole concept of Davisha Pekadusha, all this responsibility is a man's, not a woman, and therefore they cannot be counted. That was one opinion. But then already there were other opinions that you do find women can be called to the Torah. The Gemara says openly at the end of Megillah, right or wrong, Hakol Olin, and the only reason you don't call a woman to the Torah is because of it is an insult, Kavod Hatzibur, Kavod Hatzibur. And of course, there can be many reasons why Kavod Hatzibur. It's not now to go into Kavod Hatzibur, but Minig Yisrael, no, the simple shot in Kavod Hatzibur is that it's like saying to the men, you're a bunch of idiots, you don't have enough people who know how to read from the Torah. And a woman who's not obligated, she can go up and read, and she knows more than you, and and shame on you men that you don't make the effort. You have to understand that in those days when they called a woman to read from the Torah, it was not just to make the bracha, do you understand? It was literally to read. This is our minhag today, that in order to make all the bracha, how do you have a right to make bracha? You're not reading from the Torah. It should be one person making the first bracha and the last person making the last bracha. So a Talmud Chacham reads along with the Baal Koreh. And that's the famous story with the Rav, that the Rav always read along, and he read quite loud. And anyone who was a Baal Koreh, when they called the Rav up, you had to have a lot of self-confidence, because not only was the Rav standing next to you, but he was reading as you're reading. I read in a whisper, so I don't interfere with the Baal Koreh. But the Rav was audible, you could hear him reading. So, and that was from Briska Lamdanut. So that's probably the basic shot in Kavod Hatzibur. The Yemenites read
every Aliyah
they read. The Yemenites have their original Judaism. I've often said that a million times over. When I see a Chassid with payas, I sleep very well at night. When I see a Yemenite with payas, I don't sleep too well at night. For Dala Hakima, what I'm saying. So there was the opinion, that a woman is not obligated, but since she can be called to the Torah, and they work her in, that was a minority opinion, bring her into the minyan. Then there was another opinion, yes, that the times have changed, the women, and can be counted, but here's very interesting. The reason they were hesitant to permit women to be counted as a minyan, men will stop coming to shul. And here you come to an American reality. There's a joke that used to go around New York. Again, I don't know today whether this joke will be understood, but believe me, anyone who remembers the rabbinate from the 50s, the 60s, will understand it very well. That a Hasidic Rebbe says, in Europe, I was going in Europe, I went with a gabbai. In America, geich mit a gabbister. I go with a female gabbai. And what does the joke mean? What does it imply, David? It implies very simply that in America, women take religion more seriously than men. And if you recall, Yitzchak and I were rabbis out in the lowlands, not the heartlands at that time. Today, the two shuls I was with, the first shul was a year, but the second shul I built from the ground till the day I went in Aliyah. Today, they're much more major institutions. But I can tell you that my main support, the main workers, were women. And if you're going to count women to minyan, you will wind up having endless women in shul and very few men. Now, hold on 1 second. Does anyone see the modern implication? No? Have you read statistics lately? What happened at JTS? What happened at Hebrew Union College? The majority of students for the rabbinate today, and this can be checked, at JTS and Hebrew Union College, if you put them together, the majority of students are women, not men. So it shows you whoever wrote the tshuva and dealt with the fear, if we allow women to be counted to minyan, they will come to shul, the men will not. Take a look what's happened. The majority of students are women, not men. Yes, men, what did you want to say? So you see exactly what they were worried about worked out. But gentlemen, we've now come to the most important shuva of all, the shuva that... It depends on the conservative synagogue. If you see the word today, there are two crucial words, traditional conservative synagogue and egalitarian. Have you seen these words or not? In Queens, there's the famous story. Anyone here from Queens? You can see it. Walk along, what is it, 173rd Street, if I'm not mistaken, there was a big conservative temple there, a local temple. That temple had a conservative rabbi, Rabbi Straussburg. Okay? In his own life, he was totally observant. His kids went to Yeshiva College, Stern College, from wonderful children. His wife was totally observant. But he was a graduate of the seminary, and he catered to this congregation where the only innovation was mixing. Otherwise, the davening was a normal davening. Okay, so they had more English in the davening, let's say, than they had in the Young Israel of Hillcrest. But it was a traditional conservative congregation. In the greater area, there were more conservative congregations. By the 1990s, by the 2000s, you don't have conservative Jews left anymore. You're now five generations removed from Europe. Either the kids became balei tshuva, or they're totally assimilated, intermarried. Who needs a conservative temple? And now, of course, if you're going to attract anyone who's not Orthodox, you have to be up to date, the feminist movement. You have to give men and women the same role. And you know what they did in that temple? They combined with two other temples to have a tremendous parking lot. They threw out the old rabbi who was young, his 50s, but Straussburg. But he was too traditional. And they now have a tremendous sign, conservative egalitarian temple of Hillcrest. But what does egalitarian mean? Oh, it's not just the davening that's changed. It's not just the mixeding. The women are equal to men. And it's only a question of time. I don't even know. Walk by, take a look. They may have an assistant rabbi who's a woman. One day have a rabbi who's a woman, etc., etc. So it's up. Where you see the word traditional conservative, there already it's a different story. in Kugel's Hill, on Main Street. Yeah. There, where Rabbi Kirschblum was, there it's traditional. There it's not egalitarian. See, that's the difference. And that's the answer to Yitzhak's question. Nevertheless, all these problems were minor compared to the most major issue of all. You don't have to quote me here, Rabbi Sosh, who preceded Professor Arnold Einstein, said openly the biggest mistake we made, of course, was permitting the driving to shul on Shabbos. That destroyed the concept of a community. Why are you upset,
it,
Michael?
It wasn't a matter of permitting it.
It was happening. I am saying
the reality of what was being done.
Okay, now, yeah, but to permit it is a little different than reality. Okay, now, what's fascinating is...
But the tshuva was ignored anyway. The tshuva said you can only drive to the closest conservative shul.
Well, it's
the same.
Yeah, but people
don't that they wrote themselves.
Okay, one second. The three rabbis who wrote the tshuva, this tshuva is very important.
Is that the topic now?
Yeah, because it shows... This tshuva is very important because it shows the thinking from a halachic point of view and how far the conservative movement has gone from Torah Hashem to Mi'kmaq. This tshuva is classic. What's very sad for us as students sitting here in Yeshiva University, students committed to Torah Hashem, all three rabbis who wrote this tshuva had a tremendous, wonderful Torah upbringing. I don't have to go any further than Jacob Agus of Baltimore. He was a Talmud Mufak of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rabbi Revel. I refer you to Rothkopf's work on Bernard Revel, and you'll learn who Jacob Agus was. He might arguably have been the top Talmud to come out of Ritz in the 1930s. And this was Jacob Agus. Talmud Chacham began the rabbinate in Boston, friendly with the Rav, tremendous mind. It was always rumored in Baltimore, and if a Baltimorean can tell me if it's true or not, that the boys from Ne'er Yisrael and that a difficult Gemara used to go to Jacob Agus. You studied him in Dropsy.
He told me that every Thursday night he taught boys from...
Every Thursday night at Rabbi Rubin says, that boys from Ne'er Yisrael came to his house every Thursday night. You got to know who you're talking about. A London Mufak. Excuse me? What JTS? When JTS? He's a musmach of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, of Rabbi Revo, of Ramaz Magolit. Read Rothkopf's book, please. Rothkopf was a good guy. he disappeared, but that's a different story. What are you laughing at? When you go on Aliyah, you become a Baal Tshuva. Baal Tshuva has to deny his previous life. You change your name. You're now a total Jew until you come on Aliyah. What, the Jew in Muncie is a real Jew? Come on, Avital, don't play games with me. Torah commands obedience. And part of that is Kimi Tzion Tetek Torah Udavah Hashem Yerushalayim. We lived through a Holocaust. How can anyone sit in Chicago after a Shoah? It's beyond comprehension. How can I sit in England? A liberal got up there. What they say? The hatred for the Jew? Wow. And we have the leadership here. Help us build leadership. God, Netanyahu, this is leadership. The man, let me bite my lips. Come, don't let me think of our current leaders.
Yes, you wanted Rabbi Avadji Yosef.
In learning, and in Shas, come on. Any commitment of Shas to Torah Hashem Tamima is purely coincidental at best. Quote, end quote. Rakefet, a vote for Shas is a vote to give back the Kotel. Quote, end quote. You have a problem with that, Yitzchak? Please, give credit to Rakefet that he speaks truth and cannot be bought off. Baruch Hashem. Back here. Now, that's not it. Jacob Agus is one. Theodore Friedman. I knew Theodore Friedman intimately. We were very good friends. In the rabbinate, we were enemies. He had the big conservative temple down the road from my little Orthodox shul. We debated, we fought, but we were good friends. He came in Aliyah, lived around the corner from me. We were very good friends. And I can tell you, Teddy Friedman, he was president of the Rabbinical Assembly. He was a Talmud in Reeds in the 1920s. His whole original education is in East Broadway on Talmud of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. And in his own life, he was observant. His kids turned out conservative rabbis, who were Shem Shabbos. I don't know where the grandchildren are today. We were quite friendly with him, with his children. No, he wrote the Tshuva Torah. The third person, no, give me the name, Maris Adler. Who was his father? Danny, his father, did you go to MTJ in the 30s into the 40s? Were you in MTJ when Rav Moshe came to America, 1937? Not Danny, a person has to live Jewish history. Understand, you can't, Torah history is not something you just touch on the surface. It's not about Napoleon. You're dealing here with Torah Hashem Tamima. Believe me, I was in MTJ when Rav Moshe arrived, the year of my birth, 1937. Who was the Mashkiach of the yeshiva? No? Maris Adler's father, Harav Adler, was the Mashkiach. I don't recall the first name offhand, but it can be checked out. The son was Maris Adler. You can Google him, and when you get his biography, it'll mention his father. Give me other Rabbi. You tell me the first name. So you're dealing here with three individuals who were steeped in Torah and had a good education and were not narrow-minded. This is why you and they should have conquered the world for Torah. But the times were different. They went into the rabbinate in the 1930s. They went into the rabbinate where the conservative movement was winning all, where the conservative movement was the future, where orthodoxy was totally demolished. And they wrote the tshuva lahatir, driving on Shabbat. Now, I'm going to quote to you word by word from the tshuva in 1 second, but I just want to introduce it with one concept. And on a very popular level, because what I'm about to say takes years and years of shiurim. Look, we're Torah Jews. You're standing before a congregation. Rabbi, are you allowed to shave with an electric shaver? No, you give an answer. So the congregant says, Rabbi, how do you know it's permissible? How do you know it's forbidden? What are you talking about? Moshe Rabbeinu didn't shave with an electric shaver. Am I right or wrong, Danny? Rabbi, are you allowed to face... what do you do when you're in a spaceship? And you have to daven Shachris Mincha Marav and you pass... Every 24 minutes, you're going through night, day, night. Give us an answer, Rabbi. How do you know that, Rabbi? No one had spaceships at the time the Torah was given. And you can go on and on. I mean, they're unbelievable questions. Rabbi, do you use a visa? Do you pay over the year? You pay interest. Rabbi, you're allowed to pay interest visa. Who had a visa card when Moshe came down from Har Sinai? This balabas is asking legitimate questions. Well, an intelligent rabbi will explain to him, Maris, you've asked wonderful questions. I'm going to give a special lecture on how we answer questions of Jewish law. And of course, then you have to explain that we have a Torah Shebichtav and a Torah Shebaalpeh. And while the Torah Shebichtav can only cover incidents that happened or that were known or understood to Dor HaMidbar, the Torah Shebaalpeh will give us precedents, concepts, guidance, how to answer any question that will come along during the long millennium of the Jews' march before God and man. And you can give a simple example, the Malachat and Shabbat. What does it mean, Lo Tasuba Ko Malacha? The concept of Lamedet Malacha. You can lift books up and down all day Shabbat. believe me, you'll be sweating, you'll be working. But that's not malacha. Malacha means lamed tet, something creative. What is creative? What was done in the tabernacle. And we have the avat malacha, we have the toldot, but we have the ability to answer any question that should arrive by analyzing and applying the principles of Torah Shabbat Pah. Am I right or wrong? Is this what halach is all about? What are you doing in your day? Or what are you doing in Chayshe Mishpat? What does that fool Rakepet do? Gives a 20-plus year course on response to literature. No. 2.5 years to spend on a good, and what's Rakepet doing? 6 years to spend on the Holocaust? How do you answer all these questions? Who heard of a Holocaust when the Torah was given? But their principles. Okay? This is our approach. Now watch the way the tshuva begins. I'm quoting to you from a very famous book, I also knew the author, Tradition and Change, edited by Mordechai Waxman. It came out in 1958. There may have been subsequent editions. I had access to the original one, 1958. He was rabbi on the island. Michael, do you remember where? At Great Neck, I believe. Right at the start of the island.
That's right.
And it was he was an unbelievable individual in his time. Unfortunately, at the end, he wound up like every other rabbi. You know what I'm talking about? At the end, it's disgraceful. A man who had been the conservative rabbi, a new generation came along. He retired, he had to knock on doors and plead for a pension. It's a whole story with him that the end, it was literally disgraceful the way he was treated by his community. So I once asked one of his balabatim, they said, no, the rabbi doesn't have seichel, he shouldn't have done this. And, you know, right away the rabbi's at fault. The balabatim should have taken over and let him retire in dignity. But anyway, believe me, when he issued Tradition and Change, Rabbi Waxman was one of the most famous conservative rabbis in the United States of America. He came from a good Orthodox home. His father was the famous Professor Waxman, who taught at Chicago, at Skokie, who issued Rabbi, what was his, Mayor Waxman, 4 tremendous volumes, or 5 volumes, I forget already, the history of Hebrew literature and English. Man, what knowledge his father had. And this was the son. Look at the way the tshuva begins. I'm quoting from page 368. The use of an automobile involves the following activities. The kindling of lights. The indirect combustion of gasoline to produce power and locomotion from one domain to another. The combustion of gasoline to produce power is a type of work that obviously could not have been prohibited before its invention. Do you hear those words? This concept of using gasoline to produce power, which causes combustion, enabled the cars to move. Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know about it. No? Nachum Lam, were you taught? Where did you go to day school? Where did you go?
In
Tiferet Moshe. In Tiferet Moshe, they taught you that Moshe Rabbeinu went up and down Hasinai in a car? Chas v'chalila. Didn't exist. All acts of burning are prohibited only when performed for specifically described purposes, such as cooking, heating, lighting, and the need of its ashes. Burning for the sake of power was not included in this list. In other words, take a look what they are saying. It certainly cannot be a Torah prohibition to burn gasoline on Shabbat to create combustion, because at the time the Torah was given, there was no such concept. There were no computers, there were no cars, there were no planes, there were no time clocks. There were no electric shavers, and therefore all this could not be prohibited. You see, this is the exact opposite of the way we handle halacha. It's exactly the opposite of Shas and Paiskim. Everything that we know, every question we decide today, All these questions didn't exist. 99% of the questions. Whoever heard about, a minute ago, you raised the issue of ox blood in wine. Whoever heard about that was my Matan Torah. Whoever heard about that in Professor Chaim Soloveitchik's classic volume, there's not one mention of ox blood being used in wine in the Middle Ages, as far as I recall. Who else studied that volume? Anyone else here go through the whole volume? As far as I recall. Not one mention. So, excuse me?
Even scientifically, from the point of view of physics, no, heat is heat and energy is energy. I mean, you're burning a candle.
No, well, one second. Okay. Now, so therefore, it can't be prohibited by the Torah.
The Jews of the Middle Ages that dealt with wine, they deal with kashrut.
No.
Or were they just the issue?
They deal with stam yayinim, with the terrible issue of stumping out the grapes. That was the
completely different
concept. Yeah, of course. Right. Stomping out the grapes is the biggest problem of all. Was if we wouldn't be samach on Rabbeinu Tam, you could not have kosher wine in the Middle Ages. You follow? There were not enough Jews. First of all, how many Jews are going to stump wine with their feet? Understand, Jews always sought a higher profession. In Israel, we have a terrible problem. How many Jews are in the building industry? You understand, the whole building industry is in the hands of Arabs. You know it, I know it. All of Yehuda Vishomron was built by Arabs. Merkaz Arab, I give them credit that they didn't succeed. About 10 years ago, they started a whole movement to get Jewish boys to become builders. Did not succeed. It's you know, who cleans the garbage here? Ribbono Shel Olam, the garbage people are paid more than any Rosh Yeshiva is paid in Gris Kollel. I guarantee it. No, I'm serious. They had to attract them. Today, you talk to see garbage cleaners with big kippot, they paid a fortune. You can't get Jews to do it. You cannot get Jews to do it. So stomping the grapes was the biggest. This is, look into Reb Chaim's work, you'll see. And Rabbeinu Tam went out and he shows that if not for the authority of Rabbeinu Tam, the whole wine industry would have not gotten off the floor. So. The Middle Ages, what he deals with, there were real problems. All right, so then once you agree that the Gentiles, it's not stam yayinim till it's processed after it's already in liquid form, then you have other problems. The shipping, the caskets, they could stick in a straw, try to siphon off wine. Once they siphon off wine, the rest of the casket is stam yayinim. I mean, he deals with unbelievable problems. And I mean, the knowledge he shows of wine manufacturing, the secular sources in French and German, and then the Torah sources, there's no one in the world that could do a thesis, that could do a volume like my classmate did, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. Now, okay. So we all agree, according to this Chavra, it can't be prohibited by Torah law, because it didn't exist. Of course, some heat is produced in the act of combustion, but this result is neither intended nor desired by the motorist. And therefore they call it psikreshe delon nichole. I mean, can you believe that? Okay, this is mind-boggling, and this is Jacob Agis, who has smicha from Rav Moshe Soloveitchik.
And he never would have driven a car himself.
I mean, it's mind-boggling. No, how do you know he didn't drive a car? I don't know. Then why couldn't he? Why didn't he drive a car? Hence, if the combustion of gas in the carburetor is therefore the type of work classified as malacha shena tzurich legufo, and he quotes a Taisvis, Yira Lari, the malacha shena tzurich legufo, kari she'enos, he shall su malacha v'in tzarchlos et tzarech, that you don't need it, it's not the purpose, it's just a side inyan. And if this is the case, they quote the pshat in Tosfot that it is permissible. And you all know, halachically, these are concepts. Malach shenet zrichu legufo, psik reshe delo nichalo. Shmuel, you know where this comes up? Have you been to the Plaza Hotel, whatever they call it today, the Renaissance, the Ramada, the Plaza, the Shmaza, whatever hotel, on Shabbos? No, 22 stories high. An automatic elevator. Can you use an automatic elevator on Shabbat? I mean, why do we have to go to the Plaza? Rakefet lives in a building on Rehov Rav Berlin. Shabbat, the elevator is automatic, because Rakefa turns it on before Shabbat and closes it after Shabbat, right? It runs till 12 midnight, and then it starts up again about 7:30 in the morning and runs all day. Thank God. We run it all day today. Everyone in the building is from. We don't have to be cheap. Okay, how are you allowed to use the elevator? The more weight, the harder the motor works. Coming down, you regenerate electricity, the more people, you don't need so much electricity, you regenerate, no, because all that is Malach Shem Etzvich L'Gufo, it's Psikresha, if it is Psikresha, Psikresha Delo Nechale, it's Midase, these are all concepts. But look at the difference, what they're applying, where you turn on the ignition with your own two hands. And according to our concept, you're doing Malach in the Oraita, you're doing Havara. And to them, it's not Havara, it's not Eish, it's not anything, didn't exist. At the most, it's indirect, and we can be Mata. But it's only the start. Mendel, yeah.
Maybe it's a silly question, given what you're saying in general, but trying to get around...
I'm just going to talk about that. One second. Then you have another problem. No, Erev, you're traveling. Tchum Shabbos, you're carrying. To go into a car, you have to take your license with you, your keys with you, your money with you, your credit cards with you, your ownership with you. When you park the car, you have to carry it out. In New York, they rob cars. It's not like Israel. Israel, Baruch Hashem, outside of Arabs robbing cars, the cars are safe. I once was with multimillionaires from America, were taking us out for dinner and taking us to the Jerusalem Theater, and I was driving back and forth. They were here as tourists without a car. And when I parked the car, I left a sweater in the car. They say to me, "How do you leave a sweater? They won't break in and take it." But all this you got to take out. You don't leave your license, your place, your driver's license, your wallet, your visa, your rishui, how do you say that, your ownership papers, registration, whatever, card, etc., etc. No, you're going tchum, carrying, oh, what's going on here? So they say this is not a problem. Why? Because there's no rishut harabim the oraita today. And since there's no reshut harabim the oraita, carrying is not a problem. The tchum is not a problem. I want to tell you, Manhattan could be a reshut harabim the oraita for different problems. Stretch of a platja. You have streets that go all the way through Manhattan that don't go left and don't go right. The redeeming feature of Manhattan is it's an island. And there are places they say that if you stand in the center, you can see the East River and the Hudson River at the same time. So there is a redeeming feature. Anyway, you should know that a graduate of Yeshiva University, a Musmach of Reitz, who has Yori Yorin Yadin Yadin when the yeshiva during the 70s, there was a brief period where they gave Yori Yorin Yadin Yadin to people who qualified, has just completed a doctorate on Erev in Manhattan and all that's gone on about building an Erev for the last 110 years. The name of the person who did the doctorate, anybody? Rabbi Adam Mintz. Okay? Formerly the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue. So I trust that within a year or two, that doctor will appear in print, and it's going to be a very fascinating story with the East Side, with the L. You know what the L was, Danny? That you don't even know. The elevated trains. When I grew up, I could get on a train on 3rd Avenue, an elevated train, and 40 minutes later, I was on the east side of New York with that same elevated train. They knocked them down. There are very few elevated trains. You still do see it in Brooklyn. You do have some areas where the trains are elevated. I don't believe you see it in Manhattan, and I don't believe you see it in the Bronx anymore. But there was the whole Shiloh with the east side. If the elevated train, like they used telephone, post today, electric post, electric light, you know what I'm talking about? They do it Sirat HaPesach, they rent it, they connect it with a wire, and it was a whole shiloh whether the elevated train has it Sirat HaPesach, and you could use that to make an Erev. 1902, a tremendous battle was fought over the east side, and the battles of Manhattan go on until today. Very interesting, Rav Moshe did not ask in Manhattan, he asked it Brooklyn. But the reason he asks Brooklyn, I can't go into detail now, is because if you put it in Yud Bet Mil, right, Machane Yisrael, you've taken downtown Manhattan, and downtown Manhattan, I don't have to tell you, the Wall Street area, day in and day out, except for Saturday and Sunday, 600,000 more people marched through those streets. So, very interesting question. Can you build an Erev in Manhattan? Can you build an Erev in Brooklyn? Why Reb Moshe was so machmir? The Yung Av HaRav who took on Reb Moshe became persona non grata. And until today, wherever there's a neighbor in Brooklyn, thank God they let it stand for a while. They used to rip them down, which is a terrible, terrible act to do. But wherever there is an Erev, the Litvisha don't carry or carry secretly, no one should see. And the Hasidim carry Barosh Galei, Rabbinic Hebrew, in public. Now, so take a look what they are machmir, what they are matir, I should say. Burning, combustion, not a problem. Carrying, going through Reshit HaRabim, going from area to area. See, I'll tell you where they really have a problem. If you live so far from the conservative temple that you drive in an area where there are no homes, where there's no continuity, then you would have more of a problem, unless you claim the highway creates the continuity, the cars create the continuity. I don't know. But they don't deal with that because evidently that's very rare. Now, here they throw in a line that is as contemporary as you can imagine. As a matter of fact, on the basis of the strictest interpretation of the law, riding would not be prohibited on Sabbath in a public vehicle driven by non-Jews. Gentlemen, did you catch something here? Are you back in the 1990s? Are you up to date with a volume that just appeared a few months ago? Just think for one moment. Don't we have a tremendous problem in suburbia? So you build an Orthodox shul. Let's take Mount Kisco. A graduate of this kollel went to Mount Kisco. He was offered a rabbinate in Baltimore and offered a rabbinate in Mount Kisco, upstate New York. He chose Mount Kisco. He told me he wants to go to an area where there's no Yiddishkeit, and he wants to build Yiddishkeit. A fabulous individual. Talmud of mine. Talmud of this kollel. Talmud of mine many times over. By Aaron Goldscheider. He just put up an Erev for Mount Kisco. I was at the shul. I was there for Shabbos. We come out of the shul. It's next to a tremendous parking lot for the railroad that takes you into New York City. You're 40 minutes away from downtown Manhattan. You can live in Mount Kisco. It's villas on every block. How many homes do you have? Three? Four? How many homes do you have within walking distance of the shul? How many Jews live in these homes? How many wealthy Gentiles live in these homes? How many people from the Wall Street crowd live? Jew, non-Jew? New York Times. No. You come out of shul, we're starting to walk to the rabbi's house, cars are pulling out of the parking lot, waving to us. Orthodox shul, more than 100 years old. Good Shabbos, rabbi. Good Shabbos, rabbi. The rabbi there, an old-time Jew, a Talmud Chacham, a Yerushalayim, a survivor. He heard a few drushes or a few Sheyurim of mine. He made a bracha, Shechalat Mechachmato Reyav. I was, all right, I've had that before. And I'm like, please, please, I saw the Rav. I'm a nobody. I saw the Rav. How do you? Anyway, What do you do? These people. One of them is on the international board of Arsameach. You have no idea. I couldn't believe the davening, singing and feeling and kavana. They get into cars. It's a real problem. I don't know how much progress the rabbi has made, how many people he made Shomer Shabbos, but, you know, this is a terrible problem. As Michael said, with the best of intentions, you live in Mount Kisco, you buy a mansion, you have Baruch Hashem, he has there a very famous musician, Paul Schaefer, davens in the shul, right? I mean, I take a look, I see this guy on TV, Shekel Sicha, you're very, okay, beautiful. Rabbi Rishkun already proposed, it must have been in the 1990s, made a serious proposal that we have a Shabbos bus. You don't remember this. You have a guy going from place to place, picking up the Jews, a guy driving like they do here in Israel for the hospitals. No, Matan, you're going to be a medical doctor, you're going to be a nurse, whatever you're going to be, a physician's assistant, a PhD in chemistry, whatever. They need you in Hadassah on Shabbos. What do they do here? Don't they have these little buses, what do they call them, mini buses, being driven by non-Jews that has a sign on it, that it's a pickup bus for Shaarei Tzedek on Shabbos. Yom Kippur, Shabbos, it picks up doctors, picks up nurses, takes them home. It's fabulous. You solve the whole problem of a doctor, of a nurse, driving on Shabbos. What did Rav Avadya say? Goyim were created to service us. So Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem. Can anyone in the world find fault with that? Rabbi Rishkin made exactly this proposal of Shabbos bus. Michael, you think it ends with Rabbi Rishkin? When were you in Australia last? Were you ever in Melbourne? Last week won't help me. If you were there 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20 years ago, who was the most famous modern Orthodox rabbi in Melbourne? Rabbi J. Simcha Kohn. You've heard of the name? Very interesting guy. Talmud Chacham, Chaim Berlin graduate, my age. His father was head of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the secretary, Rabbi Meir Kohn. His uncle was Rosh Yeshiva of Hebron, Rabbi Aaron Kohn. We're related. I found out that I'm related to the Kohns through my great-grandmother, through that part of the family, through my mother's side of the family. We're related. He doesn't know that. If I meet him again, I'll tell it to Jay Simcha. Jay, we are related. We're not just friends. No, he's a big Talmud Chacham. You've read some of his books. He just came out with a new book this year on the Sabbath with a whole thrust, with Haskama from Rabbi Lamb. And he has a proposal that we should have a Shabbos bus. Exactly the proposal of Rabbi Rishkin. You know where he is, a rabbi today? In one of the communities in Miami Beach. In that area, Deerfield, Del Rey, one of those areas. Palm Beach, Palm Springs, whatever it's called. So what's the problem there? Danny, when have you been to Florida last? Have you been to Florida?
Once.
Did you look for wolves there? What were you doing? You're not going to find wolves. You'll find Indians who put on a show for tourists. I think half of them are Jewish, but they dress up like Indians. Anyway, I know that has to be because my wife and I were once there. And they had an alligator. Who will hold the alligator? And my wife immediately grabs it with two hands. And they say, where are you from? She says, Jerusalem. And the guy went into ecstasy. Jerusalem, Jewish. I could see right away this Indian was as Jewish as we were. Maybe more, for all I know. Now, Danny, you go there, you have communities of retirees. You are a young man. You can walk. Minzet and Elter a year. You know what it's like? Some people hit 70. They can barely walk. My mother just turned 97 the other day. She thinks she argues with me she's 98. I said to her, no, make the cheshbon, you turned 90, you're in your 98th year, but you're 97. So my mother can't walk. You understand? She's with her. She fell, broke her hip, lo aleinu. She'd be wealthy. She walks with a walker. No, how far can you walk with a walker? So Rabbi Kohn, who's a rabbi in one of these gated communities, came up with a fabulous idea. Have a bus go around from house to house and pick up these elderly Jews on Shabbos. They should be able to come to shul and not have the problem of walking that, for a young man, for Shmuel, is a 15-minute walk For them, it's an impossible 3-hour walk. You follow me, Shmuel? Think for a minute. So I can't get over it. They already paskened la halacha. Take a look what they say here. I'll tell you in a second. As a matter of fact, on the basis of the strictest interpretation of the law, riding would not be prohibited on Sabbath in a public vehicle driven by non-Jews. What happened to Rabbi Rishkin's halacha is what happened to Rabbi Kohn's halacha. Even in the book already, he makes mention that there's tremendous opposition to his proposal. The answer is very simple, that if the conservative movement permitted driving to shul on Shabbos and will permit a bus driven by Goyim, will wind up another conservative movement. The line has to be drawn. And we know the tragedy of living longer and being housebound. The best you can do is make a minyan for the person like they did for Professor Finkelstein.
So you're saying that actually according to the halacha it's a map?
You can make a case for it.
Is that a good case?
Well, if Jason Chacon is not an amoritz, that much I'll tell you. I can only tell you the following. When I came back from Russia and I contacted the Rav after Rabbi Gurin wanted to choke me, asking the shaila of using the metro or the underground or the tubes or whatever you want to call it.
The metro.
They call it the metro in Russia. In England they call it the underground or they
and
call
the
it
tubes.
And the tubes. In America we call it the subway. So I called Rebbe because I was in Russia already. By the time the shaila was thrown at me, they knew who to ask. So they really wanted me to ask Rabbi Gurin. But I think out of COVID, it was 1980-81, and they knew already that I'm a Talmud of the Rav, so they told me, you'll ask Rabbi Soloveitchik too. So after the Rabbi Gurin literally yelled and shouted at me, I called the Rav, and I spoke with the Rav, and I told Rabbi, you know, I quoted sources to him, I played the devil's advocate. And the Rav said, with all my empathy, and I understand them, and I feel for them, and I'm overwhelmed by what you're telling me, and they want to be good Jews, we cannot permit Bisman Hazeh allowing people to take the metro on Shabbos. It would just turn into another conservative movement. So that's the answer. That's what happened with Rabbi Riskin's proposal, and that's what happened with Rabbi J. Simcha's proposal. And Rabbi J. Simcha, the volume itself, alludes to the tremendous opposition. But it's amazing that they quote it, what's wrong, driven by a non-Jew. But then they go one step further. Hold on. One step further. Tell me, why can't we ride on a horse on Shabbos? Why can't we ride on a cow? And you get involved with the whole problem of being nene from the malacha of an animal. And Chazal already say that there's always the problem that if you're riding on a horse, you break a branch. You use a branch. Gezera shema yachtoch zemorot. The Gemara in Beitza. Taflamet vav amit bet. There's a whole sugya there. You break a branch on Shabbos. And then there's the question that you're having hana from the malacha of a behema, right? We are the man yanuach shachav. We are enjoined to allow our animals to rest on Shabbat, as well as our male slaves and female slaves and all that goes with it. The whole concept of Shabbat, we cannot make them work for us. So of course they say, obviously, neither reason applies to the automobile. There's no halacha in the Torah that the automobile has to rest. It's not like an animal, it's not like a slave. The apprehension that the driver might be moved to fix the car in event of a breakdown is remote, since its complicated mechanism requires the services of an expert.
So you have to have
now,
a cell phone.
One second. What is this applied to? What is this talking about? gentlemen, according to the sugya that I just quoted in Beit San, those of you that have learned Bertzan know very well, how do we dance on Shabbat? How do we dance on Yom Tov? We're not allowed to use kli shira. We're not allowed to use musical instruments. What's the yisur with using musical instruments? Musical instruments are a niece of the Rabbanon. That maybe they'll break down and we'll have to fix them. You play your guitar, the string snaps, if I'm using the right word for the string. You have to fix it, you have to replace it. So, Chazal made a gezeira that the whole concept of dancing, because if you start dancing, you'll use musical instruments. The minute you use musical instruments, you'll start repairing them on Shabbat. And they quote the Tosfot here, that Bisman Hazeh, where you need experts, you're not going to repair it yourself on Shabbat. And Ein Onu Bikiyim Lasot Klei Shirim. And out of that comes the start of the Heta, why we're allowed to dance on Shabbat. Because even if we're choshish that a guitar breaks and we'll replace a string, that's only a guitar. But to be choshish so far with dancing, that if we dance on Shabbat or dance on Yom Tov, that far to be choshish, that we're going to use guitars and worried about strings breaking, that far we don't go. So that if a car breaks down, that far to worry. Bizman Hazer, who fixes their own car? Like Yitzchak says, every member, every driver in the 50s, the 60s was a member of AAA. You called AAA in the state of Israel when you take out insurance. Part of your insurance policy on your car is a towing service, is a number that you call in case of an emergency, in case of a breakdown. I later found out that all these services work together. It doesn't matter what policy you have, doesn't matter who you belong to, what type of provision is made, the calls are handled collectively, and it is assigned to various towing trucks. You go first, you're number two, you're number three. Sometimes you have to wait hours, sometimes it's less. It depends on the pressure. But ultimately, they will come and take care of your car. So that's what they're saying, that Bizman Chazer, we don't have to worry about the car breaking down, and you are allowed to drive on Shabbat. Even if the car does break down, you will not fix it. You will call for help. Wow. I have to tell you, with dancing on Shabbat, dancing on Yom Tov, when I was learning Masechet Beyah, I was in the yeshiva.
There were no cell phones.
And I was learning Masechet Beyah, and I'm learning this Tosfot. And you'll see, relax. I was learning this Tosfot in Masechet Beitzah, Daf Lamed Vav. So I asked the Mashgiach, I was there for Shavuos, I believe, and I asked Rav Moshe Yaakov a Kohen lesson, how are we allowed to dance? Everyone was dancing, there was so much simcha and spirit, like we danced there, L'chadodi, right, Friday night, and we're dancing, and I asked him, how are we allowed? And he gave me the best answer of all. He said, "We mir getanzt in Slabotka und der Alter hat das nicht bemerkt." We danced in Slabotka in front of the Alter of Nassim Zvi Finkel on Shavuos, and he did not correct us or reprimand us or comment upon us. And that's the best answer of all. Anyway, so what do we see so far? No matter which way you look at it, it can't be a Torah prohibition. This type of malacha did not exist at the time the Torah was given. Even if there is a prohibition, it's indirect. It's malacha shein, it's richa legufo. It's psik reshe de lo nichale. The whole fear that the car will break down does not apply. we do not fix our cars on our own.
What about that flat that people do fix?
You'll see later. Hold on. The above analysis, this is the most famous paragraph now. The above analysis leads us to the conclusion that riding in an automobile on the Sabbath is at most, underline that, a rabbinically interdict, is only rabbinically forbidden. When this act prevents the fulfillment of the mitzvah of attending public worship, it shall not be considered a prohibited act. We base this conclusion upon the numerous precedents in the halacha for the setting aside of a rabbinic prohibition when a great mitzvah is involved, such as the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, or in the case of witnesses who come to testify in the appearance of the new moon, the laws of Tchumen were relaxed by a takana of Rabbi Gamliel the Elder. We may also cite the frequently quoted general principle regarding the easing of Shvut prohibitions when a great mitzvah of public welfare is involved. And what are they saying? You all know the sugya in Rosh Hashanah. Someone who comes to a strange city on Shabbat has no more than Dalar Amad. Now, why should a soldier come to fight? Why should firemen come to save people from a fire? Why should nurses come to deliver babies? Why should doctors come to save lives if they can't go more than Dalar Amad? Once they do the mitzvah, they're stuck. So what did Chazal do? They made a takana that anyone comes latzil min adleika min agiyas to deliver a baby, to save from fire, etc. You have the same tchumim as if you were in the city before Shabbat. Just like Chazal made such a takana, we are making such a takana, and you should be able to drive to shul on Shabbat. As we have already indicated, the participation in public service on the Sabbath is in the light of modern conditions to be regarded as a great mitzvah, since it is indispensable to the preservation of the religious life of American Jewry. Therefore, it is our considered opinion that the positive values involved in the participation in public worship on the Sabbath outweigh the negative values of refraining from riding in an automobile. When attendance at services is made unreasonably difficult without the use of an automobile, such use shall not be regarded as a violation of the Shabbat. And that is the very famous conclusion. What do they mean about public services? You can be a good Jew and never show your face in a shul. Right or wrong, Mendel Breitstein was a Chabad shliach to some place in Thailand. Isolated area. No minyan. He davened in his house. He never missed a mincha. He davened 3 times a day. He ate only kosher food. There was a river nearby his wife used as a mikvah. What's that to do with a shul? You follow me, Mendel? You can be the greatest Jew in the world without a shul, without a temple. Yes, you can. But 4 million American Jews, the only place they express their Judaism, feel their Judaism, is a temple. This is the reality. I had a balabas in Maplewood. He was the vice president. Joe left. I'm recalling names out of the past. So Joe Leff had been in the Young Israel, a typical American story. He still had connections with Yiddishkeit. His kids and grandchildren were totally out of it. But Joe Leff always used to say, the shul is the embassy of the Jewish people. Come into the embassy and you connect with the Jewish people. And I have to tell you, he was correct. The shuls today all over the world, every Chabad house. What's the whole purpose of a Chabad house? an embassy, a shul. And this is what these three conservative rabbis wrote, lahalacha, that this is the greatest mitzvah. Without shuls, we will not have Jews. People will not know they're Jews. They have to get to the temple Shabbos. And if there's no other way to get there, if it's unreasonable to expect them to walk a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles, 4 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles, 20 miles, you have no idea how far people drive on Shabbos. But totally permissible. And I can tell you, you think this is conservative temples only? I always tell the story, if you know Florida, Bal Harbour. You know that community right above Miami Beach? Very wealthy community. You live in Bal Harbour, that's where Joe DiMaggio lived. Do I have to say more? So there's a Chabad synagogue there. It's called The Shul. It was put up at the cost of $9 million many years ago. To put up that shul today, you would be talking $50, $60 million. You don't know what there. They brought over an old synagogue from Poland. The in the middle of the shul is the Aron Kodesh, and where they read the Torah, from Poland. What a crowd they get there. The rabbi there, the chabadnik, the shliach, he's a magician. A magician. He heads up the Aleph organization, works with Jews in jails. You've read about him. So I have a balabas, a friend, a devotee, a graduate of Talmudical Academy, Manhattan, MTA, a frum individual, not much younger than I am. Studied with Rabbi Macy Gordon, if the name means anything to you. Whenever I mention Rabbi Gordon's name to him, he tenses up as if he's back in class and Rabbi Gordon is hitting on him. And he moves to Bal Harbour and he goes into this, to the shul. Couldn't take it. He said at the end of a few weeks, he went up the block, helped organize the Young Israel, which today is trying to build or has built a new building. I don't know how the economics affected it. I said, what was wrong with the shul? He said he's davening in the shul. This guy next to him, black hat, davening with kavana. 1 week, 2 weeks, strikes up a conversation with him. It's my rabbi. I love this temple. I found myself here. Where do you live? He tells him where he lives. It's about 30 miles away, not on the coast of Florida. So he says to him, so where do you stay for Shabbos when you come to Davin? You know, what hotel do you stay in? Bal Harbour doesn't have big hotels. It's residential, has a very famous shopping area. Just to walk in there, they charge you for breathing air. You walk into the shopping area, you have no idea what the prices are. You buy a scarf, $400. A hat that you can get for $10 in Brooklyn is $299. So the guy says, oh no, I drive on Shabbos. This is my shoe. The guy drives 30 miles back and forth with a black hat to attend the embassy so he should feel Jewish. And this rabbi is the ambassador who inspires him. You have to understand what they're writing here. And I mean, when he told me that story, I said, wow, now I understand rabbis Agus, Friedman, and Adler. And this is the tshuva that changed the course of the conservative movement. Let me go just one step further. It was not the majority opinion, you should know. The majority opinion was written by Rabbi Ben-Zion Buxer. Recognize the name? He was a very prominent conservative rabbi in Queens, in Forest Hills to be more exact. Do they still remember his name in Queens today? Rabbi Buxer, Rabbi Ben-Zion? Well, I know, the neighborhood changed. It's all Russians and whatever there is Orthodox today. Yeah. Buxer. B-O-K-S-E-R. How he got the name Buxer would be interesting. Maybe his family had Buxer trees. I mean, fascinating name. Has children, grandchildren that are, some of them may be totally Shomer Shabbos as far as I know. No, tell me, how many of you drive? How many of you have been caught in a traffic jam? How many of you have seen crashes back up highways? How many of you have suddenly had a problem with your car? My dear students, I came out one morning within this past year, and in my previous car, the tire on the front left side was slashed. During the night, I have no idea why. Someone was in the parking lot, someone tried to rob, someone slashed the tire and took off the hubcap. My blood pressure must have shot up to 200 over 120. I don't have to tell you. I'm once going to Mincha, to the Shtiblach. I'm turning from Palmach into the hill that leads up to the Shtiblach, and some old Sephardi gentleman rushing to Mincha, come turning left when I'm turning right, goes right into my side. Oh, gosh, the damage he did. I don't think there's anything more frustrating, more aggravating than owning a car when you get into trouble. Believe me, when I came in Aliyah, I tried for 6 months to live without a car. I did not succeed because I was used to a car from America. But you mean to tell me that driving, you break a branch with a horse, that's why you can't use a horse, but a car, do whatever you want? What are you talking about? Driving a car? An analysis of the nature of travel under modern conditions, I'm quoting from Rabbi Buxer, page 396. Fails to bear out the contention that is free of the element of work, the precaution against possible need of cutting a twig to prod an animal, Shemiyach Tochs Mora, has its parallel in the need of guarding against mechanical failures in the car. Anyone driving an automobile is painfully aware of the possibility of a flat tire or other failures in the vehicle, and of the distractions and the anxieties which are incidental to them. One cannot set out to travel, whether in private or public vehicle, without money, papers of all kinds, writing materials, various other apprentices which contradict the atmosphere of the Sabbath. The rabbis were brilliant interpreters of human nature when they developed the principle of muksa, banning the very handling of the objects that are used in our weekday tasks, putting them out of our minds. Thus were we to escape the associations which they suggest and which will destroy the mood of the Sabbath. Travel involves the utilization of objects, all of which carry associations disturbing the Sabbath peace. No one can attain the Neshama Yetera, the oversoul, quote end quote, of the Sabbath, unless one withdraws physically as well as mentally from the mundane affairs, their associations, and the very objects which represent them for us. And I have to tell you, this paragraph is very powerful. You can see that Rabbi Buxer has appreciation for what Shabbat is all about. It's to disconnect with the humdrum, normal, ongoing, mundane continuity of existence. And if we would permit driving to shul on the Shabbat, there's no Shabbat anymore. It's one of the big problems that doctors will tell you, that al pi halacha, they can do everything on Shabbat for pikuach nefesh, and they realize it. But they will always mourn the fact that they don't have a Shabbat left anymore. I know doctors who went into areas like ophthalmology and dermatology, and they told me they went into those areas because, essentially speaking, 99% of the time, you will never get an emergency in ophthalmology or dermatology. And they told me, that's why they went into those areas. I'm not one to discourage a medical doctor. Believe me, we need top specialists in cancer, in heart, but you pay a price. I once spent the Shabbat in the home of one of the most famous doctors in Manhattan, Dr. Bernie Cabacow. If you remember the 70s, 80s, 90s, the top doctor in oncology. And I can tell you on Shabbat, the phone rang every 2 minutes, all over the United States. People calling in, how do you balance out the chemotherapy? What percentage of this, what percentage of that? And he had an answer. He was the expert. They would briefly tell him the chart, give him an idea of the patient, and he would rattle off answers. So on one hand, I have to tell you, Ein lecha mitzvah yotek gedola mizu, how many lives he aided in saving and prolonging. On the other hand, the frustration, the consternation that the Shabbat was constantly being interrupted. And this paragraph is beautiful. There's a magnificent Rambam where the Rambam, it's the Ramban and well, in Chumash, where they discuss Muktza. And they make a very similar point that people who are not well, I'll state it very dramatically, you don't work 6 days a week in addition to Shabbat. People who are not well, people who are sick, so what does it mean? So they say muktzah, that Shabbat, the fact that you abstain, that you can't touch, that the regular mundane activity schedule is interrupted, that is Shabbat. That is Zachar et Yom. That is the Zachar et Yom Shabbat Lakatsho. That's why Chazal introduced Muktzah. There's a Kiyum Deoraita because it makes the Shabbat a different day. That's exactly what Rabbi Ben Zion Buxer says here. I'll read a little bit more from his Tshuva. Very fascinating. We'll have to leave it for next week. And then I want to go into Rabbi Newlander, who I knew, and deal a little bit with electricity and see what he has to say. But I don't have to tell you, this tshuva was epic making, and this tshuva is the most famous of all the tshuva that were written, that were compiled, that came from the Committee on Jewish Law. Nothing compares to the Adler Friedman Agus tshuva, which permitted the driving to shul on Shabbat. Excuse me?
What year?
It's the 50s. I think it's 54, if I'm not mistaken. 54,
I think.
54. I'm pretty sure it's signed 54.
What these rabbis were trying to do was to justify in a halachic way what their non-halachic population was doing.
Yeah, no, I agree.
That was the issue that the conservative movement dealt with then and continues to deal with throughout its entire history.
I agree with you 100%.
So Rabbi Buxer, he refused to deal with non-halachic populations in a halachic
way. It's not that he refused to deal, but he could not find a heter. Every rabbi has to deal with it. It's not just, and if you have a synagogue, an Orthodox shul out of the big city, where 60-70% of your membership is not Shomer Shabbos, so you're going to have the same problems, but there's a limit what you can and what you can't. This is the difference.
But the rabbi showed that they could find the heter for anything.
But it's amazing, this tshuva, how the tshuva began. I mean, it's overwhelming how differently they comprehended the halakha to be.
How do they do whatever they can and force or pressure the rabbi to be for example, in the middle of the town where I was, the shul was 100% kosher. Their families kept kosher. But they wanted to have a fundraiser where everyone's a progressive dinner. That means that everybody goes to the three houses for a first
course, right.
And they go to the second course.
Right.
And they go somewhere else for dessert. And it could be that you're going to non-kosher houses.
Right.
And they're on the phone with me and counting phone.
Right,
and
right.
For 2 hours.
Right.
And the whole thing is over. And I tell them nothing doing. One guy says, I'm proud of the rabbi that he didn't give it. Right. But he was one of the guys pushing.
Pushing. The rabbi called this is the vice of the American rabbinate. There are no two ways about it. But the Orthodox rabbi is a little bit better today. Because the concept of halacha has caught on that even the New York Times understands boundaries. This article on the rapper, this article that caught the attention of the whole world now, what's his name? Skeeks, am I pronouncing?
Shine.
What's his name? Shine. Give me the name?
Shine.
Shine. Like shine, but it's S-H-A, and it's spelled differently.
Why?
This article on shine caught the attention of the whole world. The New York Times on its front page picked it up. And it's just amazing. This rapper who sat in jail for 9 years for murder.
Shooting.
They killed someone. What do you mean murder? Not murder. Homicide, whatever it's called. They fired shot. A tzaddik he wasn't. The guy speaks about Yiddishkeit with more seichel than 90% of the so-called rabbis in the world. He speaks about boundaries. And the New York Times has to publish it. So an Orthodox rabbi today has it easier. But Yitzchak and I were in the rabbinate when an Orthodox rabbi was just one step ahead of the pressures that were put on a conservative rabbi. But this is a tremendous tshuva. We have to finish out with Rabbi Buxer. We have to see Dr. Neulander with electricity. Very fascinating.
There's a second part to this.
Yeah.
In terms of only driving to Shoal.
No, right, I understand.
And B,
right.
Only driving to the closest conservative Shoal.
No. But there's also another part to it. What about, they were asked afterwards, what about doing a mitzvah like going to Bikur Cholim on Shabbos? And I want you to know, many rabbis said, no, you're allowed to go for Bikur Cholim. If it's for a good deed, you would be allowed. So then already you get involved driving to Shul, driving to a hospital. So then you can take it a little further. There's a rabbi out in the field, and his wife says to him, we want to go visit my mother today. And the guy says, but we just came back from the shul and that allows that. No, it's a mitzvah to my mother. I don't know how you can permit shopping, but there's plenty that you can permit once you take this. Yeah, go ahead. I get
some. Somebody sends a question. Yeah. There wasn't any conservative Jew out there. He probably even knew what a Kum Shabbos was, let alone sending
The rabbis had to deal with it. I want to show you something very fascinating. What we're dealing with, we're caught, the YU people, where we're caught. Wait a second, here it is, I'm sorry. First of all, what do you see in this cover? Tell me, is this a good cover, or is this a cover that represents Torah, or is anti-Torah? What do you say? He's checking a lulav. He's checking a lulav with a magnifying glass. No. This is kuntres. This is from Mishpacha. It's a very interesting issue. Gentlemen, I tell you, Danny, you see the cover? I tell you, a cover like this is against Yiddishkeit. You know why? Because you're not to check a lulav with a magnifying glass. It's not Yiddishkeit. Torah lo nitna Torah lemalachei hasharet. And what you're doing here, you're bringing out. Then you see advertisements for light boxes. It's called to check lettuce. How many of you own a light box? It goes against all of Yiddishkeit. It goes against sugis on top of sugis, chuvas on top of chuvas. What you can't see with the naked eye. Then you get involved in all the contemporary problems. So, right, there were a few tzaddikim used, David Hartman was once boasting, where this goes back to the 60s or 50s, he was once in Boston where the Rav, and he claimed the Rav was using a time clock, a stopwatch, to blow the shofar, it should be exactly these many seconds. So someone asked him, should every Jew use a stopwatch and on Rosh Hashanah when you blow shofar? And David Hartman answers, no, but in every generation you need someone like the Rav. So I don't want to say that this Jew is not a good Jew, but to show that as an ideal, I have severe doubts that it opens the world to what we have today. Don't drink water, don't do this, don't do that. But now let me show you something else. This is really something. Here there is an article on what happened to Corfu's etrogim. All right, you know what I'm talking about? There's so much written about the Etrogim from Corfu. There was a whole machlokes ha'poskim to divide them, and so many Jews preferred them and used them. And today, you don't see any Etrog from Corfu. All the Etrogim are from Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem. Who wrote the article? Dr. P. Preschel Herzog. Okay. No. What do you say, David? Who wrote the article? Okay. It's my Talmida, Pearl Preschel. Totally disguised that if Mendel would open this, he sees Dr. P. Preschel Herzog. You see, instead of being going home, he could say to his wife, take a look, honey. Here's an article by Dr. Pearl Preschel. You can strive to publish. His wife is a brilliant lady. The children will be a little bit older. She'll publish. No, they totally cover it up that Yitz Rubin should not know that it's a woman who wrote the article. I want you to know I left an email for Sherry to send out telling Pearl, I read your article, how much I enjoyed it, and thank you for the wonderful memories. Finally, this is one of the late issues of Bamishpacha, a very fascinating article on the person, Rabbi Moshe Newman, who Nachum Lamb should know. He was principal of the Beis Yaakov of Queens. And he's read the article, very intelligent insight on how to run a school and how to deal with children and how to deal with children that are different. He chats about chinuch, a career that spanned baseball deals, bar mitzvah lessons, and the establishment of a thriving girls' school. And I got to give this guy credit. He was a five-decade class act. But I may be a little bit ahead of him because, after all, I'm above 5 decades. I hope I'm a class act. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya, the Kashrut magazines of the Star K, no one's interested, had some very interesting articles, including the whole problem with the fish. And this is...